America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. It's top of mind today in the news. I'm talking about the crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border. Less well understood is why someone might send a child unaccompanied on a perilous journey to get to America, and what role America played in making those conditions so intolerable. The stories are heartbreaking, and the solutions less obvious. But it is clear that our inability to grapple with a rational immigration policy is becoming a national imperative. Climate change alone tells us that many of the regions from which people are fleeing will be uninhabitable in the years ahead. And, as in previous generations, we've turned to immigrants to refresh and repopulate what today is an ever smaller cohort of young people being born in the United States. So let's put immigration in perspective today with our guest, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, who himself is an immigrant and speaks passionately to this issue. You'll learn a great deal today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Saketu Mehta, and he's written a marvelous book called This Land Is Our Land, an Immigrant's Manifesto. In a sense, Mr. Mehta, I am wondering why you didn't put a question mark after this land is our land. Because when I think about America, what I see is a real resounding sense that this is a land of immigrants. All of us have come from somewhere. We lay claim to being a melting pot. But you've got to explain to me, why have we always, with fits and starts, rejected and then accepted people, though which with much greater reluctance if you're brown or black? What is it about the American experience that we hold so dear and yet push away so often?
Benjamin Franklin in the 1700s started railing against this group of people who were coming into the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and he criticized everything from their food habits to their language, to gods they worshipped, their manners. He called them the Palatine Boars. He was talking about Germans, the ancestors of President Trump. Then, of course, in the 19th century, you had the Know Nothing Party, who controlled tons of state houses and had a significant presence in Congress. And their whole raison d'etre was anti-Catholicism, and specifically resistance to the Irish immigrants who were coming in. Then we had the Chinese Exclusion Act in the early 20th century, and which imposed quotas on Asians like myself, which were only lifted by the 1965 Immigration Act. So throughout, you know, the founding of this country, this was a country which was, you know, populated by white settler class. And as they expanded westward, they strove energetically to keep other people from following them on their eastern flank. So the thing about America is, you know, if this country has an exceptionalism, it is this. It's a country composed of all the other countries. And that's why I'm proud to claim it as my own country. That's why I'm a citizen of America. And I wrote this book to energetically refocus the conversation on this being a country of immigrants, and to look at the reasons why people are still coming here and why they should be welcomed.
You say in the book that you realized in your own history that your humanity your dignity is determined by your nationality. Can you explain that?
This line is in reference to an experience I had in Abu Dhabi, where I briefly taught. And I taught there as an American citizen, but I'm brown. And I went to the visa office. There were separate lines for citizens of rich countries like the US and the UK, and separate lines for citizens of poor countries like India and the Philippines. And the visa offices for the people with what is called the third world passports were much longer, and the offices that they were seen, there was way more bureaucracy, they were treated much more shabbily, and I sashayed past my fellow brown brethren to go into the plush offices of reserved for the first world countries. And then I realized, you know, as I do every time I pass an immigration counter, that in the 21st century, your humanity is defined by your nationality, how you get treated, what borders you can cross, what benefits you can have is basically determined by an accident of birth or citizenship.
In your book, you chose to look at immigration globally. Were you worried at how difficult a challenge that would be? I know that you thought about the preparation for this book because it is a stunningly complex story, and yet there are certain common threads throughout. And one that you really describe in detail is the notion of migration because of colonialism. Is that the hinge that a lot of immigration really rests upon?
So in my book, it was propelled by a story that my grandfather once told me. And my grandfather was born in India in the salad days of the 20th century. Then he moved to Kenya and worked all his life there when it was a British colony. And then he retired in England. So my grandfather in the 1990s was sitting in a park in North London, and an elderly British gent comes up to him and says, "Why are you here? Why don't you go back to your own country?" And my grandfather, who was a businessman, said, "Why am I here? Because I am one of the creditors. You came to my country and you stole all my gold and diamonds. So I have come here to collect. We are here because you were there." And when he told me this story, it seemed to me a really neat summation of the reasons that so many people move from the countries of the global south to the countries of the global north. Why Arabs move to France, and why Latin Americans move to the United States, why Indians move to England. You know, we are here because you were there. And the whole debate around immigration today, you know, it's as if all these people are just coming to our doors as freeloaders and moochers, and they're coming here to enjoy, I don't know, the lights of the Eiffel Tower or a show on Broadway. They're coming here because colonialism, and then what replaced colonialism, which is corporate colonialism, and war and climate change have left them no choice.
You also talk about the fact that reparations, a term that is so misunderstood, I think, in the United States, usually attributed to slaves who have been freed, African Americans who came here without any desire to. But you talk about that in the context of immigration, of the notion of reparations, and you even put some dollar figures to it in certain cases. Explain that concept.
So I believe in immigration as reparations. When the British arrived in India at the beginning of the 18th century, India's share of world GDP was around a quarter of all world GDP. By 1947, when the British finally were kicked out, India's share of world GDP was under 4%. During the colonial period, the European share of world GDP shot up from 20% to 60%. So colonialism was an enterprise perpetrated not to save souls or give us the railway for the language, but to steal and to plunder. So when people move to places, to the formerly colonial countries, they're moving because they're entitled to, because their future has been stolen from them. And it's not just you know, the Americans say, well, we weren't a colonial country. I mean, we were a colony ourselves. Look at what the United States have done in Latin America, in places like Mexico, in the Northern Triangle countries. Between 1970 and 2010, Mexico lost $872 billion in money that's called illegal financial outflow, most of it going from corporations doing in the country to American banks. In the same period, 16 million Mexicans came to the United States. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just following the money, their money. So when I'm arguing for immigration of reparations, you know, the countries that have despoiled the rest of the planet through colonialism, corporate colonialism, and war, climate change, they have one of two options. One is to pay the debts that they owe. And the other is to let in people from these countries that they have plundered and let them come here and work and send back money in remittances. And when this happens, everyone benefits. So my book starts out as an angry book because I'm angered by the global hypocrisy around immigration. But it ends in hope. When people are let in, everyone benefits. The migrants themselves, because they are fleeing war and poverty, enormous deprivation. It benefits the countries themselves because the countries of the West just aren't making enough babies. We need immigrants. Immigrants are the lifeblood of our economy. And it benefits the countries that the immigrants move from because remittances, the money they send back in $5 and $10 giros, are the best and most targeted way of helping the global poor.
Why is that so hard for us to understand? And I'm really wondering, because we've seen the pictures, even in Europe, of the emigres coming from Syria and some of the ways they were either accepted or repelled. What is it about the world scene today where nationalism is on the rise, has been in the United States and various European countries, that really dissuades immigration?
I think the opposition to immigration is as much cultural as it is economic. I mean, the economic case for open borders is very, very strong. I mean, if you had open borders, world GDP would triple. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But even the level of immigration that we have, I mean, for most of the century, we Americans have let in 1 million new Americans every year, and the country has benefited greatly. And my book has an extensive list of figures of the economic benefits of immigration. But the cultural argument is a little harder to fight. It's saying you who are coming in now are not like us. That is, you don't speak English when you come in, or you worship different gods, or you have different political systems. And this cultural argument has been, you know, made by ostensibly liberal commentators like Andrew Sullivan and Thomas Friedman, that, you know, the country is full up, and if you let in all these people, who they won't assimilate. So I take apart the cultural argument in my book as well. There was a landmark National Academy of Sciences study which showed that today's immigrants actually assimilate faster than earlier waves of immigrants. And there are still Italian enclaves in Brooklyn where you can hear Italian grandmothers speaking only in Italian. They've got a limited command of English because they came over when they were quite young, mentally. You can go around New York City speaking only Spanish or Bengali, Urdu. You can live and work and marry using only the language that you came from. But your children learn English, and they do. So the cultural argument is the one that the nationalists use. And what I say is that the fear of immigrants is causing incalculably more damage to these countries than the migrants themselves ever could. Fear of immigrants is what gave us Donald Trump. Fear of immigrants is what gave Britain Brexit, the biggest own goal in British history. And in order to fight this fear, you know, we have to recognize that these populists, they're gifted storytellers. They can tell a false story well. And the only way to fight them is by telling a true story better. And this is where people like me come in, journalists, storytellers, and that's why the populists are so, why they fear and hate us, why they call us fake news, whether it's Modi in India or Orban in Hungary or Putin in Russia. Journalists around the world are thrown in jail, our finances are gone after, we are maligned and condemned on social media because they fear our storytelling power to tell a true story better.
Saketo Mehta is with us. The book is called This Land Is Our Land. It's fascinating to me that during this pandemic, I have seen so many people of foreign origin who are major players in our public health system. And to your point earlier, that we need more people. We are not replacing ourselves here in North America. I know so many families where they come from a family of four or five, and maybe there are two or three grandchildren among all that number. And yet we still have this notion today of, well, we only want skilled people, and yet we're going to need people at all levels of society, particularly with an aging baby boomer population, to really take on many jobs and responsibilities that I don't think anybody's going to be there to do.
Absolutely. You know, the pandemic has really served as an excuse for these nationalists in country after country to shut down their borders. Now, I agree that there is a temporary case to be made on health grounds to restrict travel from virus-stricken areas. You can do that for a few months, but these bans should not be made permanent. It's incredibly self-defeating. Migrants are 14% of the American population, but we are 29% of America's doctors. 40% of the medical and life scientists, these are the people who have given us these vaccines, are immigrants. The Pfizer vaccine was invented by two Turkish immigrants in Germany. So, you know, cutting off this incredible flow of talent is like shooting yourself in the brain to spite your nose. But it's not just skilled migrants, as you point out. We also need those with lower skills or lesser skills. We need farm workers as much as we need scientists. And if you look at the United States, it's a big empty country. The vast majority of people live on the coasts. America ranks 191st in the world for density. We are among the emptiest countries on the planet. 80% of the population live in 3% of the continent. Now, there are intelligent ways to bring in migrants. So if you look at cities like Detroit or Baltimore, there's block after block of abandoned houses. What if you let the undocumented in? What if you let immigrants in and you said, you fix up this house, we'll sell it to you for a dollar, but the condition is that you have to stay here for 3 to 5 years. So there's actually a program like this. A group of mayors has proposed a system of heartland visas, which will do exactly this, which will bring in workers to depopulated parts of the country, whether it's cities or depopulated rural areas, and give them the chance to work and build a country. Canada realizes this. Canada wants to increase its immigration intake three times. It wants to triple the number of immigrants that it takes in, because it's realized that cold countries need warm bodies.
Very interesting. What about the nationalism of this recent period in the United States? We have put up so many barriers. We've done things that are inhumane. We know that the Biden administration has rectified on day one with executive orders some of those practices and intends to do more as it relates to legislation. But what has the rest of the world looked upon America as being during this period, and how easily reconcilable to a new way of looking at immigration is the American experience as you see it?
The 4 years of the Trump administration were an unmitigated disaster for the country on many fronts, but most of all, when it comes to our reputation for being a country that is made up of all the other countries. And the worst blot on our record, I think by far, was the family separation policy, where uniformed agents of the American state literally tore shrieking babies from their mother's arms and shipped them thousands of miles across the country and jailed the parents. I was disgusted and appalled and ashamed as an American. I've never seen my country behave so badly as did, and all the people who caught up that family separation policy, such as Jeff Sessions, such as Steve Miller, such as Donald Trump and his minions, really should be prosecuted for this. It was an atrocity. It was a crime against humanity. And it was done specifically to send a message to Central Americans, primarily. That is, we know you're coming here because your country is hellish because of the wars that we have imposed on your country. But you stay there because you think life is hellish there. Wait till you come to America. We will make it even more hellish for you. We will do the worst thing we can to you as parents. We will snatch your baby from your arms. So, you know, I spoke to migrants who were coming across the border, and I remember speaking to this young woman from Honduras, this 23-year-old mother, and she had this beautiful 18-month-old boy in her arms, and I was speaking to her in a shelter in Tijuana. And she told me, this was during the height of the family separation policy, that she was going to go across and claim asylum. The gangs had come to her and told her that they would be taking her baby because her husband had witnessed a gang murder. So she gathered her baby in her arms and took the first bus out, as any of us would do with her children. And she met the legal criterion for asylum, which is a well-founded fear of persecution. And I told her, you know, if you actually go across and make this claim, they're going to take your baby away from you. You realize this. And she had tears in her eyes. And she said, I know this, but I would rather that they take my baby, who I love more than my own. I'd rather that they take him away from me. And at least I know that he's got a chance of a life somewhere, than stay home and have to put him in a hole 6 feet below the ground. This is the choice that the woman was faced with. You know, the whole international system of asylum, the covenants that the United States has signed, the legally binding covenants, were as a response to the shameful turning away of Jews who were fleeing the Holocaust. And so we vowed never to do this again. And here we were, doing it again.
Why do so many Americans, and this must frustrate you so much, not know that in so many cases we made these living conditions untenable, the story you just told about the Honduran woman, from places from which these immigrants are now fleeing? Why do we not even understand the causality here?
You know, it was interesting. In my book, I talk about having a conversation with two Border Patrol agents at the
U.S. And by the way,
Mexico
that's a
border.
Great chapter. And help us through it with that illustration.
I was speaking with these two Border Patrol agents at the U.S.-Mexico border, and one of them, who was actually Iranian-American, said he couldn't understand all these people who were just coming. And the other, who was Mexican-American, said, well, you got to look at your history and what we did in places like Guatemala, where at one point, just one American corporation, the United Fruit Company, owned 42% of all the land in Guatemala. The guns that we keep sending to them, 3/4 of all the guns in Mexico and 98% of the guns in the Caribbean are of American origin. So every time there's been some hope of democratic reform in these countries, we've sent in the Marines. We've gone in and manipulated their governments for the benefit of our corporations. We've ruined these countries. And now these people come to the home of the person who owes them, looking not for a handout, but the chance to work. I mean, you know, there's all this, people like Tom Friedman have this line, well, if you want to come here, you should come legally. Don't jump the line. Ask yourself this. Has the West ever asked permission to enter a country legally?
I hear you. I really do. Well, let me ask you, at this moment in time, particularly as it relates to America, what does comprehensive immigration reform of an authentic type look like to you?
You know, the Biden administration has shown promising signs. They have actually staffed their immigration teams with people with a lot of expertise in the field. We obviously need to do something about the 12 million undocumented people in the country. We certainly need to provide a pathway to citizenship for the migrants who were brought here as children, whose parents brought them when they were kids. They know no other country. They need to be legalized, first of all. And then, you know, we need to go back to what made the country great. The 1965 Immigration Act saw a great loosening of restrictions. It saw the Family Reunification Act, which was how my family got here. And what happened at that time, America prospered. Those who say that, loosening the borders will lead to economic decline. Well, during the Great Migration in the 19th century, fully one quarter of Europe upped and moved to America. With what result? The U.S. replaced Europe at the pinnacle of world wealth and power. And in the 21st century, what we're going to be seeing is a global competition for talent. So someone, who can code well, whether he's Indian or Filipino or Guatemalan, will be in demand all over the world. And we're going to lose out if we keep restricting immigration. During the Trump administration, the number of foreign students applying to American universities fell precipitously. So this meant that it was a loss to America on multiple levels, not just the talent that could come here and help build the country, but also for the revenue streams of these universities themselves. I teach at NYU, and a large part of our income comes from the tuition that foreign students pay. They come here and they pay full freight. So on multiple levels, what we need is just to rethink about the idea of people coming here. We can take in many more than 1 million people a year. And when people come in, everyone benefits. They benefit, we benefit, the countries that they move from benefit.
You talk about the foreign students and the lack of them coming in at this moment in time. Perhaps that can be quickly reversed. What about tourism? Because that is a huge part of the American economy as well. And finally, about the trend of Americans wanting to give up their own citizenship.
One out of five people on the island of Manhattan before the pandemic was a tourist. New York City's income, tourism is a major, major driver. Not just of cities, but I mean, if you go to the national parks in Utah, you'll hear every language on earth. People come here to admire America's natural wonders, and they come and they spend money, and they get a sense of how wonderful this country really is. And during the Trump administration, tourism also fell precipitously as we gave out fewer and fewer, we made it more and more difficult for people to come here. It was only tourism for the super wealthy, those who could prove that they had millions of dollars in the bank. Well, you know, the best kind of tourism sometimes is the young backpacker who's coming in, who's just got, you know, $20 a day to spend, but he comes here at a very impressionable age and he gets a sense of the wonderfulness of America. Then he goes back and tells his people how wonderful it is and becomes a sort of ambassador for the country. I mean, it's something that we should all be welcoming. And in terms of Americans giving up citizenship, you know, this trend certainly has accelerated during the Trump administration. And it's also as the American state cuts back on its investment in education and healthcare, more and more Americans are choosing to live abroad. Today, there are 9 million non-military Americans who are living abroad. I once wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled, Go East, Young American. And I tell my students at NYU, you know, if you want a job in journalism, go take a beat in some other country. My own son is in Tbilisi, Georgia right now. And, you know, before that he was in Brazil, before that he was in Indonesia. The planet is a wonderful place. Greater movement helps all of us, whether we're native-born or foreign-born. I live in a palace. It's called the Earth.
You have so many fascinating revelations, I think, for most of us in the book. You talk about the burden of global migration is spread very unequally. Countries that have created most of the problems, like in the United States and Europe, take in the fewest number of immigrants. You propose a migration tax, and I think people would be surprised to learn, but they won't once they read your book, they will know that most of the migrants do not go from global south to global north. They go to a slightly less poor or unstable country.
Right. So it's about 85-90%, it varies by the year, of migrants move from a poor country to a less poor country. So they move from war-torn Syria, not to Germany or America, but to Jordan or Lebanon or Turkey. And these are countries which already have very burdened social systems, but they have shown incredible generosity. I mean, you know, at one point up to a third of Lebanon's population was migrants from surrounding countries. And if climate change hits, it's really going to, I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet in terms of global migration. There's going to be a billion people on the move by the middle of the century because of hurricanes and floods and droughts. And again, you know, let's look at the chain of responsibility. Who's responsible for climate change? We Americans are 4% of the world population. We put in 1/3 of the excess carbon in the atmosphere. Europeans, another 1/4. Americans are the world's biggest carbon polluters, but we're the only country to have walked away from the Paris Accords. Now, thankfully, the Biden administration is coming back in. The U.S. military alone emits more greenhouse gases than 140 countries. The average American uses as much energy as 35 Indians or 185 Ethiopians. So the costs of climate change are going to be spread out unequally, and one way to remedy that injustice is to let people move from the climate-hit countries to the countries that are responsible for causing the emissions.
You also tell us, wow, you've got so many things that we need to better understand. 40% of all national borders in the world were made by two countries, Britain and France. Pretty remarkable. Then, finally, in closing, because I really want people to get this book, you really have so many more stories and information that we really need to have at this moment in time. We know about the border wall. We don't know exactly how much has been constructed. Again, obfuscation and lies abound. But we know there is some additional border wall that has to be torn down, and I know Joe Biden has talked about not continuing on that project. But you also, in the book, talk about Friendship Park on the California-Mexico border. Let's close with the symbolism that holds for you and what hopefully it might hold for the future here in America as it relates to immigrants.
Friendship Park was maybe the most heartbreaking reporting I've done in my career as a journalist. Friendship Park is a little patch of land where wall ends in the Pacific. It was created during the Nixon administration, a little garden where if you were on this side of the border and you had family on the other side, you could meet your family face to face, sit down with them, have a picnic, give them a hug, and then they would go back to Mexico, you would come back to America. Over successive administrations, the conditions of these visitations became more and more rigorous, and various barriers were put up, and then finally, under the Obama administration, actually, there was a fence that was put up, and under the Trump administration, when I went there, there was a thick, ugly industrial mesh fence that separated the border. So people were still allowed to meet their families face-to-face, but across this thick fence, and for 10 minutes at a time, and only on weekends, as Border Patrol agents looked on. So I went there to see what it was like for these migrants. And many of them, you know, hadn't seen, most of them hadn't seen their family for years and years. They would only talk to them, you know, once a week on Skype or on a phone call. And here they were meeting each other face to face. So I went there and saw, for example, a Mexican man who had left Mexico 17 years ago because his mom was sick and he couldn't make a living in Mexico. He came here, worked brutally hard in construction, and sent back everything that he saved back to his mother for her medical treatment. And finally, after 17 years, he was going to see his mom face to face. He'd come all the way from Colorado, and his mom had come from an interior region of Mexico. And I watched him walk up trembling to the fence and finally greet his mom after 17 years. And so there's this fence, and he couldn't give her a hug, but he could push his face up to the fence. And he told me he could feel his mom's breath on his face. And he said, "I love you, Mama." And she said, "I miss you, my son." And she said, "You look thin. You're not eating enough." It's the thing that all mothers say to their children. And he puts his hand up to the fence, and the hole in the fence is only large enough to put your pinky finger through. So he puts his pinky finger through the hole, mom puts her pinky, and their pinky fingers touch just for an instant. And all along the fence, there are mothers and children, husbands and wives, best friends, doing this, kissing of the pinkies. And it broke my heart seeing this, what states and institutions do to human beings. I mean, we depict these immigrants as criminals, rapists, you know, the language used by the Trump administration to depict people like that Mexican man was just incredibly humiliating and reprehensible. I defy anyone who has these images of immigrants to go up to Friendship Park and see family values in action, what people are willing to do for their families, and the great longing they have just for the slightest touch, this kissing of the pinkies.
Shiketu, we've been talking about so many of the issues related to immigration. I'd just like to bring us to the current moment to get your impressions of what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border. These news reports about high numbers of migrants seeking to cross into the U.S., how does this compare to past surges? Is it really that unusual what we're seeing?
So there are more numbers of migrants coming now than they did last year. There are definitely something to be said about the Biden administration's more welcoming attitude to immigrants in general that may be attracting larger numbers of them. But in terms of migration, you ain't seen nothing yet. That is, these surges or whatever you call them, the cycles, they have happened before. There have been more or less people coming depending on the weather, on conditions in the home country, on religious and school holidays. We've seen this movie before. Biden has sent Kamala Harris down to the Northern Triangle countries to look at what are called the push factors in migration. That is, why are people leaving in the first place? And that's really the only long-term solution. As climate change kicks in, as these people can't grow coffee or a farm anything else because of drought and hurricanes, as the gang wars increase, they're going to come in, you know, no matter what walls we put up or whatever the change in administration might be. So the only long-term solution is to make sure that where they live is livable. You know, these people who are coming in, these Guatemalans and Hondurans, and they don't really want to leave Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador. They have family of there. It's their home. All we need to do is make it habitable. And over the last 50 years or so, the U.S. has actively interfered in these countries for the benefits of its corporations. So we need to stop doing that, and we need to build strong systems of governance in these countries. These countries are very weak governments, and many of the politicians are tied to the narcos, the drug cartels, whose primary market, by the way, is the United States. So if we really want to do something about this in the long term, it's not enough to, you know, build a wall or to process asylum seekers faster, as the Biden administration now wants to do. We need to stop sending our guns. We need to put in aid. And Biden's taken a good first by promising $4 billion of aid to these countries. And most of all, we need to do whatever we can to ensure democratic, stable, liberal governments in these countries.
And as you look at it, I know he has sent the vice president down to talk. What signals should she be sending? And what about the support to make certain that it gets through directly to the people rather than being siphoned off by some of these corrupt governments that we have in place that are not helping the situation at all?
Two things here. One is, you know, spending $4 billion in aid is a good thing, but it's not good if half of that gets siphoned off by the government so that they can, you know, buy villas in the south of France. The money needs to get through to the people who are actually living there. And actually, the best way to do that, even through foreign aid, it's by letting people come here and send back money to their relatives. Remittances are a much better way of helping these countries than foreign aid. Last year, remittances amounted to three times all the foreign aid in the world. The vice president is going down there. She's listening. And the first thing she needs to tell them is the U.S. wants to do better. It wants to come to these countries now and give them advice on how to build stable liberal governments, not governments that will do what U.S. corporations say. That is, we want to help these countries not because it advances U.S. corporate or military interests, but because we really care for these people and we want them to have a good life at home. And the other thing is, even if they do come here at far higher rates, so far there's been, according to some estimates, some 400,000 people who are coming towards the border waiting to come in. Even if they do come in, the U.S. is still a big, empty country. We rank 23rd in the world in terms of the number of people we take in per capita. Many, many countries, including Canada, take in immigrants at far higher rates than we do. We can actually afford to take in all 400,000 of the people who are coming and actually benefit our economy. After the pandemic, the nations of the world, which have many of whom have used immigration and the supposed health risks of migration as an excuse to shut their borders, they will find that to revive their economies, they will need immigrants. If you actually wanted to jumpstart the economies of the world, the best way to do that is by opening the borders, letting more migrants come in, because the economic evidence is very clear. Greater migration leads to higher GDP.
Well, when I look at it, we've lost 550,000 people during the COVID-19 ravaging, and we have an aging population. I've got to believe, as we've discussed earlier, that we do have a tremendous need for more human potential and for the infusion of new people into our society. I think the question that a lot of people have is, how do we do it in an orderly way? How do we do it in a way that makes sense and that does help to benefit ultimately the economy and the society? And is there a plan that you look at now, some of the overall immigration plans that have been put forward in the past that have been dormant for a while, that would really do that?
Even if Congress passes Biden's immigration agenda, which is highly unlikely, given the fact that the Senate is evenly split and they're not getting rid of the filibuster anytime soon. Even if it does that, it's not going to help, because the more open the U.S. is to immigration, the more the number of people that will come in, just because the U.S. and Europe have played an active part in destabilizing and in some cases ruining these other countries. Climate change is going to be the biggest driver of migration. And there, you know, large parts of the global south will be literally uninhabitable by the middle of the century. That is, you won't be able to go out in parts of northern India without roasting to death. So it doesn't seem like the world is going to take effective action to stop or even reverse the effects of climate change. So more and more people are going to be moving. And the one thing that's needed, which is not happening, is a new global compact on migration. That is, some sort of agreement between the countries that people move from and the countries that people move to have a more equitable distribution of wealth, and understanding that there's two options we have. One is to let in people from these regions that we've despoiled, and the other is to prop up their economies by having a fairer system of trade and exchange, to actually stop interfering in their governments when there are leaders that go against American corporate interests, and to help as much as we can. And there's no sign of that happening, because there's no global agreement on migration. There's individual talks. The U.S. might talk to Mexico, but what's needed is for the U.S. to talk to all of Latin America and to Europe. So there needs to be some sort of new UN treaty on migration. There have been various abortive attempts, and generally the U.S. has declined to even participate in these talks.
Well, we're back in the climate accords, the Paris Accords. Did the Paris Accords not address the inevitability that these uninhabitable places are going to be growing on the map, and the impact that that's going to have on other places, even the United States? There are going to be some places that are going to be relatively uninhabitable.
So the Paris Accords have largely stayed away from the issue of migration as climate reparations. You know, they've certainly discussed these things. They know it's going to happen. But even the Paris Accords, finger in the dike. I mean, 10 years, it'll be too late. And right now, India, for example, is saying Indians have a right to have cars and skyscrapers just like the U.S. has, but the U.S. has put one-third of the excess carbon in the atmosphere, and Europe another quarter. And Americans and Europeans emit greenhouse gases at far higher rates per capita than Indians do. So they're asking for a certain kind of parity, and extremely tense negotiations. There are no easy solutions. So the Paris Accords, I don't really see them the way they are constructed, even with the U.S. going back into the Paris Accords. I don't really see it as an effective way to stop the Earth from going over 3 to 4 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. And that's going to be catastrophic for much of the planet. And people are going to move, and the only, you know, not even people shooting at them at the border, as for example, Turks, are going to stop them from coming. Because when you're that desperate, when you leave the children dying in front of you, you will do anything to pick them up and to wherever there is safe harbor. And yes, large parts of the U.S. too are going to be uninhabitable. But all in all, the U.S. is still a rich country, and there will still be, it will still be better off than places like India or Guatemala by the middle to end of the century in terms of the climate. Mm-hmm. There are you know, low pressure and high pressure areas, and people will move from high pressure to low pressure.
Do you see any raised consciousness now with this administration that this issue is intertwined with climate change, that there had to be a movement on an agenda. I mean, do you see this taking a forward step? Because it seems like there are so many other issues that are now getting America's attention ahead of immigration reform, even the Dreamers.
Well, I think that Biden has his heart in the right place. He'd convened a coalition, and they laid out an agenda for immigration. And they definitely recognize the importance of the push factors in migration. There's been a lot of criticism of the administration from the left. AOC had this blistering attack on the Biden policy, saying to refer to these human beings as a surge is some sort of white supremacist dog whistle. And again, she drew attention to the ignoble role the U.S. has had over the last 50 years in destabilizing Central America, in causing the current crisis. So, but there is more recognition by this administration, certainly not the Trump administration, in notions of fair play and justice. But of course, with Trump, we're really starting at the very bottom, so it's a very, very low bar. People are still a bit skeptical because when Biden was vice president, Obama presided over deportations at a historic rate. I mean, his critics called him the deporter in chief. So they're still waiting to see if Biden will be true to his professed values, if he will have a more humane immigration policy. But, you know, there's also a kind of political reality, which is that the Republicans are going to town. I think they're hoping to win the House in the midterms by creating these bogeymen of uncontrolled migrants coming in through a southern border. I mean, they're going to town with it. It's all over Fox News. They're going to have this fear of these, you know, people coming in, and they're racist fears. They're not grounded in economics. What we actually need now is more people coming in, because as you pointed out, lots of people have died and the population is aging. But, you know, in the end, arguments about immigration in this country in recent years haven't been rational. It's all heat and very little light.
No, I understand. And it's quite interesting that you say that, because you go back to 2018 and there was this notion that the Republicans were going to take the House as this impending caravan was coming. It never came, and that never happened. Well, Suketu Mehta, I want to thank you so much for what an enlightening conversation that we had. The book is called This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto. And thank you for bringing clarity and light to a subject that, as you say, has gotten nothing but more shrouded in heat and misinformation. I really do appreciate it. You're always welcome back on America Trends.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's a great pleasure chatting with you.